This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, and today we're broadcasting live from the University of Wisconsin Marathon County Theater in Wausau, Wisconsin. We have a live audience of... live audience of enthusiastic listeners to Wisconsin Public Radio, and we thank them for coming here. According to the U.S. Census, this town of roughly 38,000 people was once the whitest city in America, and I'm not talking about the snow. In 1980, less than 1% of Wausau identified as non-white. Demographics slowly began to change as local churches sponsored the city's first Hmong refugees. The Hmong fought with the U.S. during the war in Vietnam and faced persecution in their native Laos. 30 years on, Asians, most of them Hmong, make up roughly 12% of Wausau's population. In other smaller cities and towns across the country, new arrivals might be from Somalia or, more usually, from Mexico. Like Wausau, many places that used to be homogenous aren't that way anymore. We're here to learn how communities cope with unexpected strains on schools, on infrastructure, on social services, on the fabric of society, why immigrants choose Wausau over, say, Chicago or Los Angeles, on the challenges and the opportunities of immigration in small cities and towns. Later in the program, we'll talk with Victoria Houston, the author of the Loon Lake Mysteries that focus on fly fishing and felonies in Wisconsin's northern woods. But first, a look at how immigration is transforming towns in Wisconsin and across the U.S. We especially want to hear today from those of you in towns where they're experiencing a surge of immigration. How has your town reacted? If you're a recent immigrant who settled in a smaller town, why did you go there? What's life been like? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. We also have an email address, talk@npr.org. We begin with Mai Zhang Vu. She's the former president of the Hmong National Development Incorporated, an organization which helps Hmong adjust to American life. She currently works on refugee issues for Wisconsin's Department of Workforce Development and arrived in Wisconsin as a refugee in her teenage years. She's with us here in the UW Marathon County Theater. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit, if you would, how did you come to Wisconsin initially? Why did you settle here?
If I have a choice, I probably, you know, wouldn't do it if I know it's going to be so cold. But I didn't know anything about snow. And a lot of us don't have a choice in terms of where we come to in the United States. For those of you who know, our federal policy dictates how the refugees are going to resettle in the United States, and that is assimilate them as fast as we can. And so the churches have a lot to do with the sponsorship of refugees in the United States. And for me, as well as many other refugees, is through the churches, and that's how we landed in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. And what did you, as you say, cold was probably a novelty for you. What time of year did you get here initially?
We got here in March. You want to hear my story of, and I've been telling this story all my life in terms of when I do cultural training, why do I think the Americans are so white? And I'll tell that story because I think it tells a lot about how we all build our own image in our mind who the Americans are. Back in the refugee camp, I lived in the camp with my family for 5.5 years, pretty much grew up in the refugee camps myself. And our highlight of the day would be to chase these one tall, 6-foot, blonde, blue-eyed Americans in the camp and follow him wherever he goes in the camp. And when we get home, we would always ask my parents, who is this person that's so strange, monster-looking, with high nose, you know, blonde hair, blue eyes, you know, tall? And they always say, he's an American from America. So that's, you know, for hundreds of times, we formed that this is what Americans look like. So in 1980, in March, as we were about to land in Chicago, the whole country was nothing but pure white. It must be fresh, you know, 2 feet of snow on the ground. And I look out the window and turn to my oldest brother, who knew some English, and I said, now I understand. I understand why the Americans are so white, because they live in a white country. And from there on, I had to undo my bias about who the Americans are because I got so confused. Why do we have different types of Americans who are different shapes and size and colors?
A question we've been asking ourselves for years. What was school like? That can't have been easy.
Well, school was, yeah, it's like really hard. You just keep going on and you don't think about it and you don't stop. You just, like a car, you just keep driving on the highway, you know. Slow down when there's traffic, but otherwise keep moving.
Was there anyone there who spoke your language, a teacher?
No. And thanks to my older sister who's been here 5 years before us. So in Appleton, there were some Hmong families there already, and she thought the smartest thing for us to learn English really well. And this is teenager year, so me and my sister are already very well developed in, you know, size. And so learning English is pretty hard as well. And so she said, well, in Appleton, you already have a lot of Hmong students, so you're not going to study hard, so let's move you to a very small town called Kakana, 14,000, for those of you who know, between Green Bay and Appleton. And we were the only two Hmong students in the high school. So learning English was no choice but to learn it.
Sponsored by a church initially, one thing that people were surprised to learn, I understand, is that sponsorship did not last very long.
No. I always tell people that you would go crazy if you're a teacher, a social worker, whatever you do, that you have an involvement with this in the 80s, because you go crazy, because the minute, you know, our family find out where they lived or where the clan leader is, and a lot of the cluster Hmong in Wisconsin, I'll talk a little bit later on, is the reason why we have such a, you know, variety of cluster in Wisconsin is because the churches has resettled the clan leader into that town. And so I went to Kakana High School learning ABC and learning to juggle the rest of my academic years as well. And it was a survival mode, like I said, you know, you're dropping the ocean and you either learn to swim or you die. So we chose to keep going and, you know.
Did the other kids accept you? Did you make friends?
No. Not until I was able to communicate a little bit. Mm-hmm. But before that, people would just give you a weird look and kind of ask, you know, yourself, like, well, who is this person? Why is she here? You know, she doesn't belong here. That kind of look for a whole year until we were able to kind of give out some broken language and communicate with our teachers and so forth. And then by that time, my sister and I were really fortunate to have our assistant principal, who were pretty much the bridge between us and the rest of the student, where she would make a mandatory presentation in all social studies classes. Like every 10 minutes before class start, we would to go there and talk about who we are and why we're there and give the opportunity for other students to ask questions. And that's how we open up communication in the school system. And then people who like you, you know, continue to like you and help you out. People who don't, you know, they will still be there. And that's how we grow together.
Let's bring another voice into the conversation now. Brian Bull is acting news director for Wisconsin Public Radio, produced a documentary for WPR entitled Jitsa, or Suffering, Domestic Violence in Hmong Society. He's with us here at UW Marathon County Theater in Wausau. Nice to have you on the program, Brian.
A pleasure.
A couple of swift, overarching questions. Give us a sense, if you could, what it was like for towns like Wausau, smaller, predominantly white cities, when the Hmong began to arrive. Were they ready for this? Had they done any planning, any preparation?
I think a lot of the cities were taken by surprise. I don't think they knew what was coming. It's been characterized before that a lot of these church groups and charity organizations had made the invitation to bring people into their homes and their hearts, but it's one thing to say that we're going to bring these people into town. It's another thing entirely to have them there. And I think a lot of people weren't quite sure to what extent they're going to be doing this, because someone said to me, it's like the families who are currently bringing in families from the hurricane-ravaged areas of Louisiana, only doing that for 20-plus years. I don't think you could have had a greater disparity between cultures as you had between rural Midwestern Americana and the people who are coming from the mountainous terrains of Laos and Cambodia. The Hmong culture traditionally tends to be very animistic. They have a very unique language that does not have a readily available similarity in the region. You know, if you have people who come in from Mexico or even Europe, you know, you have an immediate comparison. But the Hmong language and many traditions are very unique and very singular. And so I think to bring these people in and then try to find them homes, try to find them appropriate work, I think it really kind of just bowled them over. I think in many ways they're still trying to learn who these people are, because the Hmong themselves did not have a written language until the last 50 years, and many people did not even know about the Hmong until they started arriving. They had perhaps had some precursor that they were instrumental in helping the CIA during the Vietnam War, but to bring them here and to find, you know, this very unique, different culture, I think, took these hosts by surprise. You're talking about a very Midwestern, rural, traditional, I would say fairly conservative community meeting a culture that they had absolutely no experience with whatsoever.
And quickly, just before we get to the break, Brian, 20 years ago, amidst that first wave of Hmong emigration, there were a lot of people who said, worried that these people would be on welfare forever, that they would never integrate into the economic life of this community. A quarter century on, more or less, what's happened?
I'll show you one quick figure that I got from a person who works in CAP services in neighboring Stevens Point. He said that in Portage County, within that first year, there was a 98% dependency rate on welfare. Now it's at 2%. So I think they've really overhauled. I think they've really applied themselves to learn how to get into the workforce, to learn English, and to integrate themselves, not assimilate, but integrate themselves. And I think the Hmong have really pushed themselves.
Yet there is still some degree of tension about this. We just saw a recent poll that suggested people are uneasy with immigration.
I think the percentage dropped from 78% to 47% as far as accepting diversity here in the Wausau area. And it may just be the second wave of Hmong, you know, has challenged perceptions again. It may have unearthed some of those longstanding issues. It may have been this terrible incident a couple years back between a Hmong hunter and six others where the six were killed. We can certainly talk about that more later, though. I think there's still repercussions from that, though.
And when we come back from a short break, we're going to invite our listeners here in the audience in Wausau to join the conversation. And, of course, you two listening, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Back after the break. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, coming to you today from the UW Marathon County Theater in Wausau, Wisconsin. Our topic this hour is small towns and immigration, and as you can hear, our computers are connecting with some other computers, so you're going to have to put up with some unusual sounds as we're broadcasting live from this theater today. Wausau is a natural place for this discussion. 12% of the population here are Hmong from Southeast Asia. Many other small cities and towns across the country host immigrant populations. We want to hear from them. Give us a call, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. With us here in the theater are Mai Zhang Vu, a refugee specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development, and Brian Bull, news director for Wisconsin Public Radio. And why don't we go directly to the audience, and this is Fred from Wausau.
Hi, my name is Fred Prane. I'm a lifelong resident of the city of Wausau, and welcome on behalf of the citizens. I was on the Wausau school board from the mid-'80s to the early 90s and learned firsthand the problems that a small town has with an immigration such as we had. In the early 80s, we had about 150 Southeast Asians, and by the time we did something, quote, about it, we had about 1,500, which equates to about three elementary schools. And Wausau has 13 at the present time, and so the financial impacts on the taxpayers was extensive. But more importantly, about 91, 92, we as the Board of Education decided that we've got to do something because many of our schools were at 60% Southeast Asian, non-English speaking in most cases. And the teachers and the students and the parents started giving us feedback as if we don't think there's an equality of education occurring in our district. And so we evaluated and went through a lot of different plans. We finally came up with an idea to basically join partner schools, take elementary, which was K through 5, and join them together and bus. The big word, bus, the kids. And very quickly we learned that...
Did busing prove as popular in Wausau as it did in Boston?
We felt it wasn't really a busing plan, but it was a busing plan. And if we 2020 hindsight, the town wasn't ready for it, wasn't presented well, and in essence it did not work for the town. But what it became very clear was that, you know, being born and raised in Wausau, we were not exposed to minorities. And this was a culture shock beyond imagination. It came on extremely fast, and the citizens reacted in some ways positively, in many ways negatively. Besides personal threats to many board members and myself, my daughter had a death threat. She was a first grader going to school, and she was threatened to be killed by a citizen. And that was disturbing because we're just trying to do what's right. And our goal as the Board of Education at the time was to incorporate the Southeast Asians, encourage diversity, but more importantly, we felt that we've got to teach these immigrants English. If these students do not learn English and learn it fast, they will be a burden on this town that will cost millions. And so we felt if we spread the Southeast Asians out to the 13 schools, the teachers can then focus on a smaller percent, teach them English faster, they can talk to the whites in the school faster, and they will then engage. 2020 hindsight, it did work, and it is working, because the valedictorian from one of the high schools was Southeast Asian last year. It does work, and we felt that plan was fine. In essence, what happened, though, the town revolted. They recalled the school board. We were thrown out of office. The new school board took over, reversed our plan, and then now the plan is that they choice basically Southeast Asians and bus them to the schools throughout. The bottom line is, now the schools have a little better percentage-wise. It's not up to 60% in one school. Mm-hmm. It's more like 20 to 30. Some schools have a lot less. But I think the system is working because of the results we're seeing today, 20 years later.
Thanks very much, Fred.
You bet.
Appreciate that. Majangu, get your reaction to that.
I was going to say that was a brilliant plan in terms of, you know, saving tax dollars and making sure that the city is functioning and so forth. Yes, I think for anyone when they don't know of each other, it's always going to be difficult to connect, whether you're Hmong or Caucasian or what the case is. And in my own experience, I think, you know, if we approach everything from the level where we are at, then we're not going to be threatened about it. For example, when we moved into Kakana, our neighbor, who is our became our godmother after a while, had a large family like us, so they have a lot of similarity, where when Christmas holiday, Thanksgiving holiday comes in, the icebreaker of food is what brings the two parents who don't speak the language to come together when all of us, the kids, are speaking English together and walk around the neighborhood and, you know, storm from Earth and Bernie's house, you know, and their kids come and do the same to our house. But our parents and their parents don't speak the same language, but the food is a great icebreaker because they eat and, you know, they'll do their nonverbal thing. And so I think in accepting anyone is, you know, take it at the level that you have and do that. And I think what they're trying to do here in Wausau, you know, was a great strand. The other thing is when people are learning about each other's language, some people may overdo it and some people may do it without knowing what it is. And I remember our church, our sponsor was, you know, trying so hard to make sure that we don't go hungry. So this is what they do. They always bring us food. Of course, they bring us food that we don't like. And so, you know, when you first come to this country, dairy food stinks. I have to say that, you know. And they bring these large jar, cheddar cheese bar, these long stick ones. And we don't eat them. So we, you know, for Hmong, we have to be polite. We have to, you know, act like we like the food. So we took it. And then when they leave, we put it underneath the car, you know, the cabin. And we would be, every day, they would be, you know, they come back with another cheese bar. We put it back in there, you know. And they do that for a whole week. Of course, we have a whole cabin of cheese in the drawer, in the kitchen drawer. And then one day, they, you know, the woman came and she was looking for something. She opened all the drawers and she saw all the cheese bar that she brought. And she asked why we didn't eat it. And we said, well, we don't like it. And she said, well, why didn't you tell us that you don't like it? Well, it's not polite to do that. You know, so people have good intention. It's just that they don't know about it. And sometimes, you know, it doesn't become useful. It become, you know, a funny story. But it's the, you know, it's the effort that counts.
Yeah. Brian Bull, let me ask you another part of some of the things that were brought up by Fred Prain, and that is, before the Hmong arrived, the town of Wausau did not have a meeting and vote. Do you want to change the character of the town? Do you want to build three more elementary schools? Do you want to spend more tax money in all of the... Nobody said beforehand that this was going to happen. Mm-hmm. As it happened, there was a feeling, I think, am I right about this, of, hey, this is spinning out of control. This isn't what we wanted.
Mm-hmm. No, it would be accurate. There had been no plans for any mass migration of refugees into the state. In fact, from what I recall, you know, Wausau was leveling off as far as many things, including its development. And, you know, generally it was regarded as an all-American city. And it had a lot of ideals. It was regarded by many people, and still is, I think, as a Midwestern paradise. You know, middle income, very ideal standard of living. And I think if there's any lingering resentment that I've gathered from a number of people who I've talked to from those days is that it seemed to be this collaboration, maybe an unspoken collaboration at least, between these charity groups and church organizations and the federal government to bring these people, drop them off at the front step, and then be done with it. It was basically typified as dropping people off and not having any further say or involvement in it. Hmm. The same gentleman who quoted the welfare dependency figures said, basically they gave them to us, we had to accommodate, it was a community-wide organization and effort to really get these people on board with us and teach them the English and get them integrated in the schools, and the feds didn't lift a finger to help us out.
Hmm. In 2002, Talk of the Nation spoke to a city council member in Lewiston, Maine. At the time, that city was experiencing a major influx of Somali refugees. The mayor at the time, Larry Raymond, wrote a public letter to Somali community leaders asking them to discourage more Somalis from going to Lewiston, Maine. For an update on the situation, we turn now to Phil Nadeau. He's the deputy city administrator of Lewiston, and he joins us now by phone from that town. Nice to have you on the program, sir.
Nice to be here, Neil. Thank you for inviting me.
What's changed since 2002?
Well, I'm listening to the show, I'm struck by the similarities between Wausau's experience particularly in the early years of their refugee resettlement and Lewiston's experience with the relocation of Somali refugees to our community. For the listeners that aren't familiar with Lewiston's story, the one significant difference between what occurred in Lewiston and what has occurred in Wausau over the course of the last 25 years or so is that Lewiston's relocation occurred without a single individual actually being resettled by any of the refugee resettlement agencies in the United States in Lewiston. This occurred only because a few families were relocated from Portland, Maine, which is about 40 miles to our south, because of a housing and shelter crisis that they were experiencing at that time in their city. We relocated a few Somali families to Lewiston in February of 2001, and that literally triggered a relocation which has now produced a community of about 2,500 Somalis in Lewiston to date.
And how are they integrating into the community? Are there disproportionate numbers of their children in schools, or are they on welfare, or are they working?
I think all of what you heard about the Wausau experience is strikingly similar to Lewiston in many ways, outside of the fact that Wausau's experience was part of an actual programmed relocation resettlement in that community by the resettlement agencies. We experienced a lot of the same issues that were confronted by Wausau in the early years. The fact that we had a population coming in that was that wasn't programmed, that they were actually coming from other communities around the United States. They were coming from Georgia and from Minnesota and from Ohio. And the fact that they were merely just literally showing up on our doorstep without any agency bringing the families into our community created a set of challenges that were somewhat different than Wausau because we didn't have the refugee resettlement agencies present in our community. We didn't have those churches, those support organizations ready to support, at least provide that initial year of support that refugee families will get through the federal government funding process. But we have been able to marshal enough of our local resources and have been able to be creative enough so that we think we've met at least the preliminary need, which is shelter and food and making the service and program accommodations that they often need. the issue that we're now confronted with is the longer term issues. Much of what you've heard about the need to provide English as a second language education to students and to adults, and the fact that we now have a chronic unemployment problem and a high level of dependency on federal welfare and local state welfare programs, not unlike what Wausau was experiencing in the early going.
And is there resentment in Lewiston, Maine?
Well, I think the community has responded quite favorably under the circumstances. I think a lot of what you've heard already about, those who might express some resentment about the fact that they didn't get a choice to vote about this. They didn't elect to have this occur in their community, and that these folks just suddenly showed up into the community requiring this high level of service, was certainly confronted by some resentment. But I would have to say that I wouldn't characterize the resentment as being kind of this xenophobic reaction. I think what was being expressed, you know, in 2002 by Mayor Raymond, the fact that he received so much local support, I think wasn't the product of a xenophobic reaction. I think it had much more to do with what you're hearing about, which is the failure of the federal government to put in sufficient funding into a system that requires, a level of support that goes well beyond that first year for many refugee populations that come into the United States, the ongoing need for language education, the ongoing need for job training, and all of the other things that populations like the Hmong and the Somali populations that are here in the United States require because of their backgrounds. These are, these are people in crisis that are coming into a situation they know little about, and they need a fairly high level of support for an extended period of time. And the federal government's refugee resettlement funding mechanism doesn't respond in that manner. It's dependent on having private agencies and these church agencies, nonprofits, step up and provide that gap funding that's needed for communities to get that additional work done. And I think the deficiency in the way the system is set up is that the federal government expects that most of the relocation is going to occur in the metropolitan areas, which it does. But when it begins to occur in smaller communities, they just don't have the resource base to be able to handle it financially and have to be very creative in coming up with the resources that are needed.
Phil Nadeau, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil. I appreciate the time. Thanks.
Phil Nadeau, Deputy City Administrator in Lewiston, Maine. Let's turn now to another member of our panel here, and that's Catherine Fennelly, a professor of public policy at the University of Minnesota. She's also here at the UW Marathon County Theater in Wausau. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you.
And it's interesting, listening to what Phil Nadeau was saying about Lewiston, Maine, illustrates a couple of points about patterns of immigration, one of which is it used to be that immigrants arrived in this country in New York or Los Angeles or San Francisco, ports, and they sort of acted as membranes that slowly brought them into the mainstream of America. Lewiston, Maine? Wausau, Wisconsin?
Well, it's still true that the majority of immigrants arrive on the coastal states and the border states, but there has been a rapid increase in the numbers of immigrants and the percentage of immigrants who are moving to heretofore white, in some cases, rural destinations.
And the other thing he talked about was this sort of secondary immigration. They may have arrived in Los Angeles, but for one reason or another, usually family, they then move to Lewiston.
I think that's also always been true. I mean, there are two things that really distinguish the majority of immigration patterns in the United States from what we've been talking about with the Hmong and Somali refugees, and that is that the majority of immigrants are not refugees, and secondly, the majority live in urban areas. And then thirdly, the cases where immigrants move to rural towns, it's generally for work, so that a situation such as the one that the mayor of Lewiston was describing, where there's high unemployment, is fairly unusual. Usually it's rural communities that have perhaps food processing or manufacturing and are trying to bring in young workers.
And we keep hearing about jobs that Americans aren't happy to do. I think in one of your studies you talk a lot about the meatpacking industry.
Meatpacking, especially here in the Midwest and parts of the South, is a real lure for immigrants to small towns. Poultry production, pork, beef, very important source of employment and one that is predominantly staffed by immigrants, at least on what they call the evisceration lines.
Right now we're talking about the immigration in smaller cities and towns. Our guests are Mahjong Vu, Brian Bull, and also still with us is Catherine Fennelly. Mahjong Vu is a refugee program specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. Brian Bull, acting news director for Wisconsin Public Radio, and Catherine Fennelly, professor of public policy at the University of Minnesota. Let's get a caller on the line, and let's go to Susan. Susan's calling us from Chester Springs in Pennsylvania.
Yes, hi. I had a comment and sort of a question. When the gentleman said that there needed to be more government involvement in supporting people, say, from Somalia or wherever they're coming from, I pay a lot of taxes, and I see my money going here, there, and everywhere. I mean, we have Katrina. I had extensive damage in Florida, and I get no help from FEMA or the government. I have to pay myself. Just how much can we bear? How much burden does the taxpayer, how much money is there from our taxes? We can only do so much.
Brian Bull, I'm going to put you on the spot in that regard.
I was afraid of that.
And I'm also going to ask you to talk a little bit about the obviously short-term expenditures, and we heard a lot about that in terms of the school system earlier. Mm-hmm. Longer-term benefits, though.
You know, that's a real stumper, I confess, because, you know, how much is enough weighed against, you know, a person's own individual investment in their community? I mean, I don't think there's a straightforward answer for that, and if someone does have that, I'd love to hear the formula. I think that the immediate terms that they're looking at would have to do with learning English as a second language, I think, is the biggest, most mm-hmm. immediate need for many of these people to transition well.
Catherine Fennelly, what do you think?
It's something that we talk about quite a bit in public policy circles. The best studies show that when you look just at short-term costs, let's say English language classes, what you're not paying attention to is the long-term fiscal benefits, the taxes that are paid by immigrants, the jobs that are created. And taxes include retail taxes as well as income taxes, creation of new businesses, creation of new jobs. And in an aging society, that's quite significant.
Mm-hmm. One other question also. There are parts of the country, including parts of the Midwest, that are experiencing population declines. Isn't this an injection of population, young people particularly?
Absolutely. And I was thinking about that when you were talking to the mayor of Lewiston, because I think perhaps the only thing that a superintendent fears more than rapid change and having to perhaps teach new languages or teach intensive English is the consolidation and closure of schools because of declining enrollments. That's occurring all over the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another question from the audience here in Wausau.
And my name is Pete Oberhauser. I actually am from Clintonville, Wisconsin. My question is concerning the cultural integration of immigrants and practices in the United States. And I'm referring particularly to a book that Ann Fadiman wrote, The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down, which was about a medical situation in Merced, California. And the book was brilliantly researched, and she talked about the problems of integrating a medical culture that had evolved among the Hmong over a period of many, many centuries, probably a couple thousand years. And it was a terrific problem trying to integrate that long-time culture into a medical practice in the United States. And my question is, has there been any experience that you've had that has related to that problem and with the culture that you had brought to this country?
Mahjong Vu, I guess that's to you.
To me. I think the issue that you raise is a very important one. And providers are trying, as we're speaking, to integrate some of these in there. For example, one of the successful model that we have in Wisconsin is the Cashier House in Madison, where they integrate the holistic approach of serving the Hmong community where, you know, before a surgery is going to be made or something, you know, they would respect the elder and the family structure enough to consult with them before they put the process in. And so everybody worked hand to hand. In my own family, we have to, and for my unique way, I always get to be the cultural broker between my family and my people to the community, and that is to educate why we need to do things a certain way. So, for example, in a community that we believe that we will be reincarnated, and when we die, we need to be whole. Every part in us physically has to be intact. So if you're going to, you know, open me up and do something.
Take out your appendix, eh?
Right. Or like when I have my gallstone removed, I have to educate my mom for 6 months before I could do it. You know, and so you have to really take it back to why we believe the way we believe and why we do that, and then that education has to come in. So it's a slow process, but I think when providers go in with the respect of that culture, then everybody come together and things can be done. But the clash is when people say, well, this is our way, and the judge said we have the right to do this, and we're going to do surgery on you without you having a say in that, then of course it's going to be a clash. So things are slowly coming down. Another book that just came out besides the one that you mentioned is called Healing by Heart, and that's written by two physicians, a Hmong physician and a Caucasian physician, and that gives another side of, you know, a more elaborate in terms of this issue. So I think we're facing that issue, but it's coming together. As a marriage, we're learning to live with each other.
Let's see if we get one more caller in. This is Pressy. Pressy's calling from Tallahassee. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
You are. Thanks for taking my call, Neil. This is a great topic for a show.
Thanks. Thanks.
Unfortunately, you're about 20 or 30 years late. I say that because my family came to Iowa in 1976, and I always think back as kind of an interesting coincidence that we came to the States as America was celebrating its 200th bicentennial.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to make a point. One of the reasons why I say it, I think your show is 25 years too late is your last caller, Susan, I think she illustrates my point. I think had Americans or had our neighbors known why we were here in the States, that we had, in fact, fought for the United States during the Vietnam War and the war in Southeast Asia, I think we probably would have received a warmer reception, not that there weren't a lot of Iowans who helped us out. My other comment is that I understand that there's a new wave of Hmong refugees that have just started to come over since I believe the refugee camps in Thailand are being closed down if they haven't already. My question, it's a twofold question. My question is how are the preparations for their arrival different from the first wave?
Mm-hmm.
And secondly...
We're just going to have to deal with just that one, Pressy. I'm sorry, because we're
a little short
on time, but let me put that to Catherine Fennelly. Yes, of course, tell us about the situation about the Hmong refugees still in Asia, but also we're obviously talking about groups other than Hmong, just Hmong, but anyway.
Right. I think there's a theme here, which is that the United States really needs better policies for integration and for education of U.S.-born citizens about the immigrants who are coming in, about their backgrounds and histories, and about the enormous diversity that exists within these groups. When the refugee camps closed in Thailand, we have colleagues in Minnesota, including the mayor of St. Paul, who went to the Krabbeck refugee camp and brought home some of the refugees. And many of them were helped by the second and third generation Hmong who were at this point established in the Twin Cities. And so that's another thing that I think we have to recognize is the help that refugees and immigrants get from their forebears.
Thanks to everybody on our panel. We appreciate some of you, I know, went out of your way to be with us today. Thanks to those of you who called in with questions and had them in the audience as well. I know we could go on, but we're running a little short of time. Mai Zhang Vu is a refugee program specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. Brian Bull, acting news director for Wisconsin Public Radio. And Catherine Fennelly, professor of public policy at the University of Minnesota, all with us here at the UW Marathon County Theater. Thanks very much.
Thank you.